So what Maite said about pressure is true. As I was preparing this talk, I was painfully aware of the fact that if you're giving a talk on how to give a great talk, and then your talk isn't itself great, it kind of undermines your credibility. but what I hope to show you is that, I mean, giving a great talk requires a lot of time and energy. And unfortunately, I don't think I was able to devote enough time and energy to this particular talk. So I hope that I can still persuade you that some of these are good ideas and that maybe you will do as I say rather than as I do. We'll see. Okay, so the first question, of course, is, you know, why should you bother worrying about giving good talks at all? You know, we're here to make discoveries in theoretical physics, so why don't we just focus all our energy on making, you know, great discoveries? So the first thing I would say is that if you have a career in theoretical physics or, you know, academia more generally, it really is sort of one of the greatest pleasures to be able to give a talk that really resonates with your audience, really goes over well and gets a warm reception. Certainly, like, I found that it's one of my absolute favorite things. If I can give a talk and, you know, you spend so much of your time thinking deeply about certain ideas, and if you have an audience who's engaged, interested in those ideas, wants to hear what you have to say, it's really rewarding. You can, especially if you do it well and you can connect with your audience, it's just a fantastic feeling. So for me, that's really the main reason why you would want to invest in giving good talks, is that it's truly very satisfying. But there are sort of more pragmatic considerations. So the first is that good science actually requires good communication. So it's not enough to just, you know, make the discoveries. You need to find a way of communicating that to your peers. And, you know, it reminds me of this joke, which maybe you've heard, that, you know, somebody gets up, gives a seminar on their latest discovery, and then somebody at the back of the room stands up and says, but I discovered all of this 25 years ago. And the speaker responds, but now that I've discovered it, it will stay discovered. And that's the punchline. but I think there's some truth to it, that you know, it does no good to discover something if somehow that piece of information doesn't get consolidated into, you know, the framework of what we know. And so part of that is being able to explain results clearly enough that, you know, people can understand how they fit in. And so that's where good science communication comes in. Every talk is a job talk. This is a slogan you might have heard. And the idea there is that in a job talk, of course, you know, you're going to put on the best show possible. You're going to prepare really well for it. You're going to try to make your talk as slick as possible because there's so much on the line. So whether you get the job or not depends on it. But ultimately, you know, the slogan is meant to say that, you know, every talk you give is an opportunity. It's you don't know who's in that audience. And it could be, you know, somebody who could offer you a job. It could be somebody who wants to invite you to give a seminar at their conference or in their institution. It could be a potential collaborator. So there's often a sort of a lot on the line. And if you make a habit of it, ensuring that every talk you give is, you know, top notch and very slick, it sort of increases the opportunities you have. And it's important to remember that, you know, your reputation does precede you. So if you manage to perfect these skills and you get a good reputation, you know, a reputation for giving good talks, then I can tell you that every conference organizer, every seminar series organizer, they're looking for speakers who give great engaging talks. They don't want to bring an audience in and have a non-engaging talk. So if you can manage to sort of build that reputation, then you'll be high on the list of anybody who wants to give, you know, a seminar, organize a conference. They will want to invite you. And that means more opportunities for you to, you know, present your results. Okay, so that's the essence of this. Of course, you're not going to want to put you know, unlimited effort into every single talk you give. You do have to kind of scale your effort with who you think the audience is. But if you're very mindful about, you know, what it is to give a good talk and you start building good habits, then ultimately those will sort of influence how all your talks are given. They'll make all your talks better. Okay, final thing on that topic is that it does no good to say, oh, well, you know, this particular aspect of the job is just not something I'm particularly good at, so I'm not going to worry too much about it. Nobody is born a great public speaker. Just, you know, like everything else, it's really an acquired skill. And how do you become really skillful? With a lot of practice, a lot of sort of mindful practice, thinking about what is it that makes for being a good speaker and what is it that makes for really good talks. That's why, you know, you need to sort of start and really focus on trying to give as many talks as you can, because the more talks you can give, The more practice you can acquire, the better you'll become. In my case, I started out as a very bad public speaker, but I got very lucky because I had a job in my undergrad in a park where I was basically like a naturalist who gave, you know, guided hikes and talked about the trees and the wildlife. And every 2 weeks, I gave a presentation in an outdoor amphitheater with campers who would, you know, get up because their kids had to go to bed or whatever. So it was sort of a bit chaotic. The stakes were low, but it meant that every 2 weeks I had to have another hour-long presentation ready, and it had to be good, and I didn't want people to leave. And it was really great because it just meant I could, you know, make mistakes. The stakes were low. I could get better and better. And so when it came time to start learning about how to do physics talks, I had a little bit of skill, but I had to learn a lot about what makes a good physics talk, which is not generic for any talk. There's a lot of things that are particular to physics talks. And so it's been a, you know, a long road of, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what works, you know, what was it about a particular talk that got a particularly good response, trying to figure out, you know, what an audience needs to see. Okay, so let's get into the details of some advice. What are the three most important elements of a great talk? This also holds true for a great paper. And the answer is narrative, narrative, narrative. That is the most important thing. Okay, so remember that giving a talk is basically just storytelling. So the most important thing is that, you know, telling a story, it should be an engaging story. You know, it should have a sort of arc. It should make sense. People should come away understanding, you know, what that talk was about, right? It's the narrative that goes through the talk that's the most critical thing for making it enjoyable to your audience. So in particular, you know, every particular piece of your talk ought to, you know, relate to the overall narrative. So it does no good to have some, you know, really slick explanation of something in the middle of your talk if the audience can't connect that to the broader theme and the thesis that you're trying to communicate. So, you know, for example, if there's some point in your talk where you just want to make an aside and it actually isn't relevant for the main thesis, then you need to make that clear so the audience doesn't get confused. And if at some point you're describing some theorem and then the proof, then it should be very clear when it is you're stating exactly what the theorem shows and when it is that you're describing, you know, the reasons that it's true. All of that has to be in place so that the narrative can come through clearly. There's a nice analogy to visual art. So I don't know if any of you do some drawing. So years ago, I used to do a lot of life drawing. And what I found was that the more time you devote to the composition, so the composition is sort of a rough sketch of how things are going to be laid out on the page. If you don't devote enough time to that, then it doesn't really matter if you know, you did an exquisite, you know, work on the face and the hands and so on. As soon as when it's all done and you step back, you'll realize it's hideous because the proportions are wrong, and you know, you'll want to throw it away. And so then you'll realize, oh, I wasted those hours of all those fine details on something that had a bad foundation. And it's, in my experience, it's exactly the same way with talks, that you know, you can put as much energy as you like into the sort of fine details of a particular slide or a particular topic, but if you haven't got that through line of a sort of strong narrative and it's clear what you're trying to persuade your audience of, it's not going to work well. So keep the composition in mind. You should also remember that generally you can only hope to leave your audience with, you know, one or two main points, right? Don't try to persuade them of 10 different things. You know, your narrative should be chosen so that at the end of the day, there's just a few things that they're definitely coming away with that they won't forget after the talk's done. This is a really important thing to always keep in mind, that as you're preparing your talk, you've got to be thinking about your audience. The same is true when you're writing a paper. Like you must absolutely know, who am I writing this for? Who am I giving this talk for? What's the intended audience? What's their level of expertise? So in physics, we see, you know, that there's sort of two main failure modes where you get the audience right. You get the audience wrong. So the one is when you're giving a presentation and you've pitched it too high. So, you know, maybe you have non-experts in the audience, but your presentation basically presumes expertise on this topic. Maybe there's even students in the audience. And what happens is after 5 to 10 minutes, the audience realizes, I'm never going to follow the rest of this, and they start checking their phone, and they just check out completely and are, you know, desperate for the thing to be over. And that happens a lot because, you know, people will lose their audience because they've pitched it too high. But what I've also seen happen is somebody can come in not realizing that the audience does have expertise on a topic and pitch their talk way too low and explain things that everybody in the audience knows full well. And then people are bored, and in fact, you know, their intelligence is being insulted. So in that way, it's even worse to pitch it too low. In some cases, your audience is mixed. You're going to have some students, some experts. And in those situations, typically what you want to do is you want to put a bit into the talk for both types of audiences. So, you know, you want to set it up so that somebody who's not an expert can understand. And then maybe you also want to throw in some things that, you know, will appeal to the experts. And, you know, maybe you can even tell the audience, well, this, you know, next slide will make sense to the expert, but maybe not to the rest of you. And then everybody comes away feeling like, you know, they were addressed, you know, like they would acknowledge that they were there and they were thought of. If you get invited to give a seminar or a colloquium somewhere, and you're not clear on what the audience is going to be, you don't know if it's, say, just the physics department or whether there's other departments, you don't know if the master's students are coming, you have to get clear on that. So I've often emailed people saying, you know, please tell me exactly what I should expect. Now, how big is this audience going to be? What's it going to consist of? You know, what do you expect? Because that is really where you start, you know, figuring out what you want to say in your talk based on what audience is there. So it's a really bad idea to try to prepare a talk without knowing who your audience is. Good. Maybe some of you have seen this quote from Fermi. It gets brought up in the context of physics talks. You can read it for yourself. I think there might be some truth to it, particularly if you manage to explain something that your audience already knows in a particularly novel or clear way, then they might have some satisfaction. But in my experience, this is definitely not the recipe for a great talk. In fact, what makes for a great talk is when your audience learns something. So if you can give a talk, so you know you need to have a good result. Assuming you have a good result that your audience is interested in, if you manage to communicate that clearly, and at the end of the day, they realize that they now understand something they didn't before, or maybe it challenges something they believed, or it leads them to, you know, question something that they thought was true, or maybe it even makes them sort of think carefully about things. All of that is really what an audience will reward you for. That's what they're really in it for. Because, you know, as scientists, the greatest compliment somebody can give us is a challenge, not a compliment, but the greatest service they can do for us is a challenge to our ideas. If somebody can say, something you believe is wrong, correct that in your worldview, that's a great asset. Now, you know, my whole picture of the world is firmer because I've corrected that mistake. And so in my experience, audiences really respond well to learning things that they didn't know before. And for that, you really need to be able to, you know, not only have a great result, but find a way of explaining it clearly. So most of the work of giving a great talk is, you know, finding great explanations. And, you know, finding great explanations is hard work. It requires understanding what you're doing, you know, very deeply. There's, you know, some advice I can offer you, which is that in my experience, the best explanations are those that manage to eliminate as much as possible unimportant details, you know, things that maybe were important for you discovering that or important historically, but they're really not the essence of the explanation. So if you've got a result and, you know, you can prove it extremely generally in lots of different contexts, but actually sort of the key idea is already there in a very simple example, you want to go for that simple example because that's the one that the audience is going to most easily be able to grab onto and understand. So you don't want to fall into the trap of, you know, trying to impress people with how general and complicated some result is, because then they, you know, just have to take your word for it. They won't be able to follow. If you can really give them, you know, an idea in a simple form, then they'll be with you and they'll appreciate it much more. And in particular, if you can sort of make it seem, you know, retrospectively trivial, that's a good thing. If you can make it seem trivial, that's great. You've done your job right. You've explained it so well that it becomes trivial. And then you can start building on that. If something seems trivial, you can build a lot more stuff on top of that because people are with you. So I'm not going to give many examples of great explanations, but I think the Feynman Lectures of Physics, which probably you guys know, has a lot of nice examples of really great explanations in it. So if you look, for example, Feynman's explanation of GR, it's amazing sort of how far he gets in a short space of time by not sort of starting by giving you all the formalism, but trying to explain, you know, the ideas behind non-Euclidean geometry. And it's a really an amazing example of sort of great novel explanation. And I feel like that's the kind of thing that you want to have in your talks. If you want to be able to make a lot of headway, cover a lot of ground, teach your audience something, you have to find ways of explaining things more clearly than they've been explained before so that you can sort of get there and sort of tell them something new. All right. So I'm now going to sort of switch gears into more nitty-gritty details of how to prepare a presentation. So I'm going to sort of do it at three levels. One, starting with the kind of what goes on a particular slide, and then I'll just sort of go to sort of broader, maybe a topic in your talk, and then I'll talk about sort of the organization of the whole talk. So what are the considerations on a given slide? The key thing to remember is that you want to keep your audience's attention. That's your sort of main resource. You want to keep people engaged. So a white background, which is usually there on the templates, is actually pretty hard to stare at. And so if you can get away with a dark background, it's actually much better. Sometimes that's difficult because you're importing PDFs and they have some background and it just looks strange. So you can't always get away with it. Sometimes you're sort of forced to use the white background. But if you can get away with using a darker background, it tends to make a much better presentation, much easier for the audience. And mid-tones also much better than that bright white. So you can use that in some circumstances. You have to know facts about human perception. So, facts about human perception is that your eyes will naturally be drawn to the big stuff. So whatever you put is, big on your slide, that's where people's eyes are naturally going to be drawn. So it better be the most important thing on that slide. So that's where people's eyes are going. So you can make things bigger to draw people's attention. If you use contrast, same thing. Their eyes are naturally going to be drawn to that contrasting point. If you have an arrow, then you just can't help it. You're going to look at where the arrow's pointing. It's just a sort of natural progression. And finally, you can use animations. So if your eyes are drawn to whatever changes from one slide to the next, because it shows up, it's not showing up everywhere on the slide, but if there's something that changes that motion at a particular point in the slide, will draw the audience's attention, right to that point. Obviously, there's no point putting the transcript of exactly what you're going to say as text on your slide because it divides the audience's attention between listening to you and reading what's on your slides. And instead, you should use your slides as a complement to what you were saying. So I think you've probably all had that experience before. I'm guessing you were all sort of maybe reading ahead and you read faster than I can speak. So you're on this sentence and I'm speaking back here. And so your attention's divided. You're kind of getting it, but really your attention's divided between reading and listening to what I'm saying. So this is a really bad idea. I'm not managing your attention well if I'm just reading off my slides. There's no reason to have the sentences, the transcript of what I'm going to say, because you can understand perfectly well what I'm saying. You don't need to be reading it on the slide. So you should always eliminate that kind of stuff. When I do this, I sometimes do this, usually I realize after the fact that it's a crutch. I'm preparing some slides in a hurry, and I'm like, oh, there's this thing I just remembered I have to say, and I'm going to forget, so I better put that here. Better put that sentence here so I remember to say it. And you, of course, have the presenter's view for that purpose. I'm using it right now. You don't need to put that stuff on the slide. You can put it in the presenter's view. And then, if you forget and you want to be reminded, what do I have to say on this slide? It's there in the presenter's view, and now you're not dividing your audience's attention between the text and what you're saying. Okay, so the theme here of all these cases is that it's all about focusing your audience's attention on the right thing. And this is what magicians are very good at. They'll point to something, the ball that's in this hand, and what they're really doing is they're making sure that your attention is in a particular place so that they can deceive you. But as a speaker, you're doing the opposite. You're focusing attention to make sure that your audience is enlightened, to make sure that they're not deceived, to make sure that they're paying attention to the thing that they have to be paying attention to in order to understand what you're saying. Okay. Let's talk about the kind of standard template that you'll find in a lot of software packages like PowerPoint for preparing slides. So I just sort of picked one at random here. This is terrible, and you should not use this. So what's so bad about this? Well, often these things have a border, a header or a footer. And you'll see often people put their institutional logo in the border, maybe the date, maybe the name of the talk and the name of the speaker. And so there's all this information that appears on every slide. Think about a storyteller. A storyteller would not tell you every couple of minutes in the story, oh, and by the way, this is the story about my friend. Forget that. Obviously you don't need to be seeing and hearing that information over and over again. It was there at the beginning, and now we know where we are, right? So we don't, there's just absolutely no point repeating the information. And what is it doing? It's distracting the audience. They're going to be drawn to there. And it's not what I want your attention on. I want your attention on the thing that I'm explaining in this moment, okay? So these headers and footers are bad. They just draw the audience's attention. Same thing with the page number. What on earth would I want an audience to know the page number for? Like, maybe they're desperate to, for my talk to be over, and they're, counting down. And if that's the case, then I'm in real trouble, because I don't want them to be counting down. But yeah, more generally, there's just no reason for them, their attention to be drawn. And this particular slide is a terrible design because, this is like an arrow that's like pointing. And so I don't know about you, but I can't look at this without constantly being reminded that this is page 8 out of 9. It is the absolute most important thing on this slide somehow. So yeah, you don't want to do this. Another thing you'll notice is that, it always is the case that the size of the title up there is sort of the biggest thing. So whatever the subject heading of this slide is, that's the biggest thing. That's where your eye is going to be drawn. But again, typically, the subject heading of your slide is not the most important thing. It's not what you're trying to explain. You want the audience's attention on the very thing you're trying to explain here in the middle of the slide, right? You don't want their eyes being drawn back to that giant title at the top. So I'm going to suggest that, instead of putting titles on the top of your slides, which I did for many years, you should instead use transition slides. And I'll show you some examples of that in a little bit. Okay, so I'm actually going to come back to some of these points in a moment with some examples. But first, I want to sort of broaden a little bit and say, all right, let's consider things at the level of a given sort of topic in your presentation rather than a single slide. So the natural inclination, I would say, and this is certainly my inclination for many, many years, is to organize your talk where sort of one slide, one topic. And so I remember very clearly saying, all right, well, that topic, I'm going to need this figure. I'm going to need these equations. I'm going to need this text. If I'm going to do justice to this topic, all those things are going to have to be there in the slide. And I don't know quite how I'm going to fit them all in, but I'm going to get them all there, and then I can explain everything there is to do with that topic. But what I've learned is that that's really not the recipe for success. What actually works best is if you dedicate one slide per unit of thing you're trying to communicate. So, one slide for a given concept that you're defining. Now, then the audience can be focused on the definition of that concept and nothing else. One idea per example that you're presenting for, something. One slide for one figure. And if it turns out that at some point you need to sort of take, a figure and an example and sort of put them side by side and talk about the relationship between them, well, you can do that on another slide. And now the focus of that slide is the relationship between these two things. You've already covered each thing individually. Now we're going to talk about the relationship. There's really no reason to throw it all into a single slide. So, all right, let me proceed with an example of some of these things I've been talking about. And the tricky thing here is that I thought it'd be useful to have sort of an example of how not to do it, in addition to an example of how to do it well. But I didn't really want to shame anybody, so I thought I have to go find a talk of mine that's really bad. So I dug back into the archives and found one of the first talks I gave on a topic of contextuality and quantum theory. And it's not terrible, but I think it exhibits a lot of the sort of bad habits that I had. And I'm going to contrast it with sort of a more recent version of talks on the same material, which sort of incorporate years of sort of perfecting that and realizing what works and what doesn't. And of course, I mean, this is just going to be a snippet of a longer talk, so you're not really going to get all the physics. But hopefully, I can explain enough of the physics that, maybe some of the choices make sense. But if you're not getting exactly what I'm saying about the physics, don't worry about it. It would take too long. I can't give the whole talk. So here we go. So this comes at a point in a talk about contextuality where I've already sort of said that contextuality is a feature of hidden variable models. So there's certain hidden variable models that are called non-contextual. And basically, a hidden variable model is trying to explain some operational phenomena, some experimental procedures, statistics that you get for those procedures. And to be non-contextual is basically to be context independent. And so, you have to define what a context is to understand what context independence is. So I come to the slide where I'm going to define what a context is. So I have this giant title up here, defining the context of a procedure, the biggest thing with, context highlighted. And then I have this attempt at a kind of Venn diagram. And I have sort of all this stuff pointing in. I say, okay, so this Venn diagram represents the set of all procedures, all experimental procedures. So every dot here is a different experimental procedure. And now they're organized into these subsets, and the different subsets are different operational equivalence classes of procedures. And what a context is a difference among procedures that's sort of within one of these classes. So if there's variations of a procedure within one of these equivalence classes, I'll call that a variation of context, a difference of context. All right, so that's not too bad. And then I particularize to the case where the procedures are preparation procedures, so things that will spit out some quantum system. And I repurpose my little Venn diagram, but now these little dots represent preparation procedures. And by the way, I'm also particularizing to quantum mechanics at the same time. Okay, so we've switched to arbitrary procedures to preparation, but also we switched to talking about quantum mechanics in particular. And in quantum mechanics, these different bubbles are represented by density operators. Definition of a context is still something that sort of, you know, varies in your preparation procedure, but doesn't change the density operator. And then, I can tell you what preparation non-contextuality is over here in the corner. It's when the distribution over the hidden variables for a given preparation procedure P depends only on the density operator associated with that procedure and not on the context, not on, you know, where it is in that equivalence class. Okay, then I move on to start talking about examples. And it doesn't really matter what the examples are. There's two of them, bunch of text. And these are actually whole families of examples. They're not particularly concrete. I say, a given density operator has lots of pure state ensembles that can be used to build it up. And so there's sort of ambiguity of mixtures. So that's the first type of example. There's also lots of purifications. So that's meant to kind of illustrate, you know, how this comes about. And then I'm on to a different case, which is a case where the procedures are measurements. In that case, I repurposed the same diagram. It's exactly the same diagram, but now the points are measurements, not preparations anymore. But there's the same sort of structure that, you know, I have these subsets. These equivalent classes are now associated to positive operator valued measures rather than density operators. Still these contexts. I get my definition of non-contextuality from measurements over here. And again, I get a list of examples. There's three of them this time. Why three? Why did I need those examples? Were they critical, what I was explaining? This was really the critical bit. So anyhow, there's a lot going on here. There's a lot to look at by the time the slide's done. I don't think this is really the clearest explanation of these kinds of topics. So let me show you what I think is a much better presentation. I'm sure it too could be improved, but it's the presentation I tend to use these days. So, you know, again, the talk has already presented a bunch of background material on, you know, operational theories, procedures, what hidden variable models are, preparation procedures are represented by distributions of the hidden variable model. And then I come to, all right, now I'm going to tell you what preparation non-contextuality is. Okay, well, the next part of the talk is about understanding preparation non-contextuality. Not the title on the slide, it's just a transition, right? Just like in a story, I'm going to say, you know, now I'm going to tell you what happened to Bilbo. You know, I don't need to remind you every 2 minutes that I'm telling you what happened to Bilbo. It's clear from the beginning. All right, so we transition. Now look, it's nice and clean. There's nothing at the top of the screen anymore to distract you. And so now I can say, all right, what I want you to imagine is, you know, for some degree of freedom, like, I don't know, photon polarization or something, over here, this represents the set of all preparation procedures I might do for that degree of freedom. And so there's lots of different ones. And I'm just going to sort of use these colors as sort of icons for ways that those preparation procedures could be different. So, you know, it could be whether you're using Polaroid or birefringent crystal, you know, any distinction among preparations you can think of, you know, that's all in here, different preparations. Similarly, a whole battery of possible measurements I can do on that same degree of freedom. Now, once I have that, I can start defining notions of operational equivalence. So I can look at two of these guys, like say preparation one and preparation four, and I can say, all right, I'm going to say they're equivalent just in case they give the same statistics for all measurements. So I take P1, I put it in front of M1, I run this experiment many times, I find the relative frequencies of different outcomes for M1, and I say, all right, that's the probability distribution of outcomes for M1. Then I do that with P1 and M2 and M3, M4, and I find all those distributions. And then I do that for P4, and lo and behold, I find it's exactly the same distribution for every one of those measurements. In that case, I say P1 and P4 are operational equivalent, and I'm going to denote it like this. So now, unlike before, where I already sort of had all those subsets, I've explained to you what this means before I put it on the slide. So now you know what I'm representing, what operational equivalence means. And then I can very easily say, all right, well, I can do that for all the procedures, and I can divide them up into operational equivalence classes. Just figure out what's equivalent to what. And then now that I've sort of explained it in a sort of concrete way, I can give you some formalism and say, all right, well, two procedures will be said to be operational equivalent, which is denoted this way, if for all measurements, the distribution over outcome X of measurement M for P is the same as for P prime. Okay, and so that's the more formal definition, which I'm going to use later in the talk. But hopefully at this point it's sort of conceptually clear what's going on. Now I can focus your attention on just, you know, what is the difference of equivalence class? It's a, you know, difference between one of these bubbles and one of these bubbles. There's not a lot of other stuff going on. You have no choice but to look there as I say that. And similarly, what's left over is a difference of context. So this is a difference of procedures within a given operational equivalence class. No distractions. You're just focused on that. And now I can make a transition and say, we're going to talk about an example now. Okay, so I've already defined operational equivalence on a different slide, and now we're into an example, and I can particularize to quantum theory. So I'm not particularizing to preparations in quantum theory at the same time. Now I'm just talking about, let's have an example. And so in quantum theory, this difference of equivalence classes is a difference of density operators, but there are still differences in the formalism that I can't represent that way. So for example, if I have a qubit, and this procedure over here, P4, you know, it flips a coin and prepares the qubit in the zero or the one state. Well, if I don't know the outcome of the coin flip, I represent that by the completely mixed state. But this procedure over here does something totally different. It flips a coin and it prepares it in either the plus or the minus state and doesn't tell me which. And that's also the completely mixed state. And it means that if you put one of these two things in a black box and you let me measure any measurement on that black box, I can't tell which of the two is inside. They give exactly the same statistics. So that's the sense in which this is an example of operational equivalence. So what's better about that example than the one with the pure state ensemble is it's very concrete. It's the simplest example I can think of this kind of operational equivalence. And so it makes it sort of clearer, I think, you know, what we're talking about here. You don't need to see what the whole class of examples looks like. It's enough to really see sort of one example to know what sort of thing we're talking about. Okay, and then finally I can say, all right, now I can tell you what a preparation non-contextual model is. It's a hidden variable model where the probability distribution over hidden variables that represents these procedures, which I've established earlier in the talk is sort of what a hidden variable one does, is the same for all the procedures in a given equivalence class. And so then I have just this little cartoon of what that means. I say, oh, hey, there's a distribution, the same one for everything in here. And then I can contrast that with what it looks like if I have a contextual model, one that fails to be non-contextual. And that's where different elements have different distributions. And again, these are just sort of iconic. There's no real model here, but they're meant to sort of emphasize this is, you know, what different distributions could be. It really sort of makes that clear that these are obviously not the same distribution. And once I have this sort of nice cartoon of what's going on, I can explain very clearly why these contextual models are somehow a bit less plausible than the non-contextual models, because I can say, remember how every measurement among all measurements could not distinguish these two preparations. The only way to explain that in this kind of model is to say that all of these measurements are somehow deficient. They're coarse-grained in such a way that they can't see these differences between these distributions. None of them are fine-grained enough to see those differences. Whereas in the non-contextual model, the reason that they give the same statistics for this preparation is because these two preparations are sampling the hidden variables from exactly the same distribution. So there's no opportunity for telling them apart. So it's an inference to the best explanation. This seems a much more plausible explanation than the other one. So that's the essential story. I can then, you know, make other points about preparation non-contextuality. Now that I've sort of explained it, I can go back to my sort of formal description here, and then I can pick out things that I couldn't easily do in those sort of cartoon versions. I can say, well, you know, it's hard to test this experimentally because in an experiment, I only have a finite number of samples. So I only have a sort of finite sample of a probability. I have relative frequencies. How can I ever know that two probabilities for preparation P and P prime are exactly the same? I never find that out in an experiment. So there's a problem with experimentally testing this kind of thing, given that I can never know that I really have equality. Or over here, the universal quantifier says, oh, you have to test this for all measurements. But wait, I can't do all measurements in the lab. So now I can sort of pick out things of this more abstract definition that would be harder to say in the kind of friendly presentation. And then I can move on to measurements. And I've already, you know, well set up because the measurements are already here on all the slides. I can talk about operational equivalence classes, define non-contextuality, and I won't do it. But it's, you know, the parallel story. And it's very clear that now we've shifted over to talking about measurements. I'm not reusing the same set as kind of a symmetric sort of definition. Okay, so that's the example. What are the takeaways? For a long time, you know, maybe you've heard it as well, that there's sort of this mantra that, you know, if your talk's too long, you've got to use fewer slides. That's really bad advice, in my opinion. It sort of goes along with the idea that, you know, it's one slide per topic. You just throw everything into one slide. Typically, you hear things like, oh, every slide will take you about 2 minutes. So if you've got, you know, 15 minutes, oh, you should have about 7 slides. But that's under the presumption that, you know, you're spending 2 minutes describing everything on a slide. If you think about what I just showed you, a lot of those slides went by in 10 seconds, 20 seconds. You know, they're just making one point and then moving on. So I replaced what was like 3 slides at the beginning with something like 15 or 16 slides. But it didn't take longer to explain. I think I explained a bit more on the other slides. But you know, in the end, if you use multiple slides, generally you're going to do it faster because you're not tripping up. And you know, often if you do things poorly, people get confused. They ask you questions. That slows you down. Having this presentation, sort of one slide per idea, I find sort of speeds up the presentation, allows you to say more, not less. It allows you to say it in a way that's clearer and less likely to be misunderstood. Okay, let me give an example of a similar flavor for sort of bullet point lists, which show up a lot in talks. So you know, imagine I'm giving a talk about quantum foundations, and I come to a point where I want to say, well, these results have these interesting applications in quantum information, and they are you know, analyzing circuit structures in quantum computation, optimizing quantum communication networks, and new protocols for quantum cryptography. Now, the way I just did it, it's not great because, you know, all these things are here on the slide. They're competing for your attention. I'm not sort of focusing you in on the thing I'm saying. And, you know, I'm imagining that I would say a couple of minutes of details for each of these, right? So I'd stop here and say, in what sense I have applications here, and I would stop here for a few minutes and talk about that. So this is not a great way to do that. Now, what you see in some of these templates is this kind of scheme where everything shows up in gray, and then as I talk about different things, they materialize and become dark. And this is terrible because if you're anything like me, I can't help but to go read the next thing in gray. It's just a compulsion, you know? You're really going to just ignore that? No. While the speaker is telling you about this, you're going to go look and say, well, what's coming next? I want to read. And so, you know, what happens? You divide the attention of your audience. It's a terrible scheme. So you can avoid that by just saying, all right, well, first I'm going to tell you about this. And I talk about that for 2 minutes. And then I let the next one appear. Personally, I think if it spins in from the side, that's also pretty bad because it's distracting. So just have it appear, and you know, I move on to the next one. So that's a lot better. It still, you know, creates a bit of clutter by the time the slide's done. There's other things to look at. So why not do it this way? I'm going to tell you about the application. So I spend 2 minutes talking about the applications to quantum computation. Now I'm talking about the applications to quantum communication networks. And third, I'm talking about quantum cryptography. And of course, that's how it would be in a story. You wouldn't, you know, you would just one after the other. You can keep track of what's going on as you explain these three applications. But now there's sort of one thing that remains, which is that, you know, at the top of the slide, I had this title, application. That's like, you know, reminding you all the time that it's Bilbo's story. Why do you need that? You don't. So ideally, I think what you should do here is just have a transition slide, like we talked about before, where you say, okay, now we come, you know, you can make it fancy if you want or just simple, but, you know, now we come to the really exciting applications of these ideas. And now I'm going to tell you about each one, and I don't need the text there because you speak English, you know what, you know, if I say it, you'll understand it. So now I can use my slides as just a pretty background, and you're going to focus on what I'm saying. There'll be nothing to read on the slide. So, you know, here's me talking about the applications to quantum computing. This is a nice little cartoon about quantum computing that you can just stare at while you're listening to me talk about this application. And now I'm on to communication networks. And in a way, it's just sort of a visual icon. So if later in the talk I want to say to you, oh, you remember when I was talking about quantum communication networks? If I throw this up, you can be like, oh, yeah, I remember that bit of the talk. We have this very sort of clear memory of like, oh, I saw this thing that was distinctive at this time. It brings me back to that moment. So these sorts of visuals can also be useful as just sort of helping you to navigate the audience, remind them of different topics, you know, and then you can have something for cryptography. Okay, what about considerations at the level of sort of the organization of the whole talk? The key thing, as I said, is, you know, you want your audience's attention. So from the very beginning of your talk, you have to somehow get them kind of invested in what you're saying. You have to sort of have them hooked and interested. So ideally, you know, your introduction is great and it's an interesting topic. And so your audience is just, you know, really waiting to hear what results you have. But there's also, you know, tricks you can use that sort of involve getting the audience to participate in some way, because that tends to sort of focus people's attention if they're not just being totally passive. Okay, so if you have, you know, come up with some scheme to have the audience interact with you in some way, I find that this generally makes everybody in the room sort of more alert, more engaged with what's going on. So I'll give you sort of one example from a talk. So, you know, close to the beginning of my talk, it's a talk about symmetry breaking, things like that. I introduced Curie's principle. This is Pierre Curie. It's the principle that any asymmetry in a physical effect must be found in its causes. And if you're like me, you probably had never heard of Curie's principle. But actually, we sort of all implicitly use this all the time as physicists. So, you know, when we're doing a problem set in undergrad, and we get an answer that breaks some symmetry, and then we notice that the initial condition didn't break the symmetry, and the dynamics didn't break the symmetry, our reaction is, we must have made a mistake. Let's go back and figure out what's going on here. So that's sort of the intuition behind Curie's principle. There's a lot more I could say about it, but let's sort of leave it there. What I do next in the talk is I say, hey, even though we have all these strong intuitions that it should hold in our physical theories, there's some examples that seem that maybe it could be violated. So the first would be, you know, I have this cylindrically symmetric column and I push on it till it buckles in a particular direction. And then I pause and I ask the audience, okay, show of hands, who thinks this is a violation of Curie's principle? And then in that moment, they have to stop and start thinking and they want to give the right answer. And so they want to put up their hands only if for the answer that they think is right, you know, and so everybody's stopping and thinking, and then I move on to the next example, which is a quantum wave function that's in a spherically symmetric wave packet expanding, and then I have this blue detector, and then I find the particle in some particular position and localize it there, and I say, is that an example of a violation of Curie's principle? Show of hands. And generally what happens at that point is that people get a bit worked up. I usually have people saying, oh, well, hang on, your question's not well posed. What do you mean by this? And there's about it, and I have to kind of contain it and say, okay, great, 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 great. I'm happy you're engaged, but I got to cut this down because I want to tell you what I think about this, right? But it's great because everybody's sort of now keen to know, you know, what's going to happen next. Is my answer the right answer? Maybe they want to fight with me about it. But they're definitely engaged, you know, and they're not asleep and they're not checking their phones and they're paying attention. And so anything you can do of that flavor, where, like, I don't know, you present a paradox or a puzzle or something counterintuitive, that'll just get people thinking and have some skin in the game, have an opinion about how it should turn out, is really useful because it means that you're going to have their attention. And that's really what you want, that you want their attention for the whole talk. It's hard to do. But if you have it, then and yet you're doing your job well, you can actually explain what you came to explain. All right, a couple of other organizational points. So often we're told at the beginning of our talks, we should have an outline slide. Bullet point one is my introduction, which you've just heard. Bullet point two is the preliminaries that you'll need to know to understand the rest of the talk. And bullet point three is topic X. And we get on to topic Y, topic Z. It's really boring. And it's not what you see in a story. You know, you don't open the Lord of the Rings and hear that Bilbo leaves the Shire and then he goes to Mirkwood. And, you know, here are all the major plot points that you can expect over the next three books. That would just be terrible. And it's the same with a talk. You don't want to just say, here's everything that's going to happen in my talk in a bullet form list. It doesn't work well. It is true that you might sometimes need to give signposts, sort of like, okay, the next part of the talk might be hard to follow unless I give you some signposts as to what's coming. There's going to be three different topics here, and I'm going to explain them one at a time. And that's exactly the same in a story. There comes points in stories where things do get convoluted, and, you know, the author has to say, dear reader, now I'm going to need to tell you what happened to this character, but also what happened at the same time to this character, and here's how I'm going to do it, and that's your signpost. And that happens in talks, and in those situations, you might want to have a little bit of an outline of what's coming next. But in my experience, it's pretty rare. And in my experience, you can sort of safely drop the outline slide, and no one's ever complained. It's always made my talks better not to have a boring bullet point list of outline, but just to get into the material and start telling the story and explaining. It always works much better. The same is true for a slide that usually comes at the end, which is sort of conclusions as a summary of the points I've covered. Like, in this talk, I have, you know, tried to convince you of point one, and I've tried to convince you of point two and point three, and it's, you know, you should remember that these are all the things I've done. It's the same problem. It's very boring. If you made your points well during the talk, people will remember them. If you didn't make them well, seeing them in a bullet point list, maybe it'll make them remember them a little bit better, not much better, but it also costs you something because you could be using that time we're explaining something. All the time in the talk is precious. You know, I find the problem in talks is they're never long enough. You always want to sort of cover more material, teach your audience more, got to squeeze it all in. So things like a summary of all your points can easily go. It's not high value. What you should be doing at the end of your talk is essentially sort of re-articulating the main thesis of your talk. You know, your audience is now in a much better position to understand that point that you were making at the beginning, because they have this whole talk of details and conceptual scheme behind them now. And so you can re-articulate, you know, what the main message is and how what you've been saying supports that. And then you can try to sort of connect it maybe to the big picture, a broader picture of what's going on. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, future directions. But you're still in that mode of explaining, right? You're still in the mode of sort of giving new information. You're not just summarizing with a bullet point list what you've already done. All right. Just have a drink. Maite, how am I doing on time?
Yeah, you have 5-10 minutes. I'm going to give you 1 second for questions.
Okay, great. I think I want to say a few little things about parts of talks that are particular to theoretical physics, so things like figures and data visualization. So I recently had to write a paper where I just needed to show kind of a non-contextuality inequality, so a bound on the trade-off between two quantities that implied by a non-contextual model and the trade-off that you see in quantum theory. So I just plugged those things into Wolfram Alpha, and I'm showing you sort of what Wolfram Alpha's output is. And it's not great. It's not the kind of thing that you'd want to see up on a slide, because it's not easy to see what the most important parts are. This is the kind of way you should represent that same data. So the fonts are much larger. It's very clear that we're plotting this V versus D, whatever they are. It's very clear what the intervals all are. And you know, I'm specifically making a decision that all you really need to know is that this goes from 0 to 1. If I wanted to emphasize that when D is 0.5, the blue curve intersects the V line at a particular, I would do it differently. But here, I just want to emphasize the difference in these two kinds of functional forms. And so I have this very big font over here on the two functional forms of those inequalities. I've got some text that tells you what it is. And it's much clearer sort of what's going on. You don't have to squint. You're more likely to sort of get the key points in this plot when I'm talking about it. Here's another example from another paper of mine of just a histogram coming out of a data analysis of an experiment. So we basically have some experimental data, and then we're fitting it to different models. You kind of don't need to know what they are, but the models are parameterized by this integer k. We have all these different models. And then we're plotting here what's called the AKEK information criterion score, so the AIC score. And the AIC score is basically trying to weigh together both how well your model fits the data, but also to what how many parameters it used to get that fit. So it's also sort of trying to capture so the balance between underfitting and overfitting. So the way it works is that, you know, the lower the AIC score, the better the model. So the thing we want to communicate with this plot is that rank 4 is the minimum. That's the preferred model. And the problem we had was that, you know, ranks 2 and 3 are terrible models. Their AIC score is huge compared to these guys. So if we just plotted this on a linear curve, these guys would look flat, right? So, you know, you have to sort of figure out, how am I going to present this so that the main feature jumps out? And so, what do? You cut this axis. You fill in this thing with a log plot over here so that all you really care about is that these guys are really big. And then I can clearly see that these guys are increasing, so this is the minimum. So these are all the kinds of things that you are sort of, you know, when you're in the trenches deciding, how am I going to present this stuff? The question you always be asking yourself is, what do I want to leap out at the reader or the audience? You know, what do I want them to see in this plot? All right, one other example of that sort is, actually, maybe I'll skip this example because you got the basic idea. I'll just mention that there's a couple of, there's many books out there on this sort of stuff, data visualization. Edward Tufte is a particularly famous author who's written many books on this. I recommend those. I've, for some years, looked at this blog, Information is Beautiful, which also has a nice, sort of teaches you how to present data nicely. A couple of words now about presenting math in talks. So generally, I don't like to present mathematical proofs of theorems in my field. It generally is the case that, you know, the priority for a talk is to present, make sure your audience understands the theorem, all the concepts, but not the proof. You know, they can go to the paper for the proof. It's very unusual for me to present a mathematical proof in the context of a talk. Generally, they're not that informative. You know, you might tell your audience what the proof sketch looks like, you know, why it's likely to be true, but you generally don't want to go through step-by-step the proof. But I can understand, you know, there's some context where you might want to make an exception, and maybe in some fields and then for some results, it's sort of more important to present the proofs. So let me just make a few comments about that. And I feel like this is a place where I could certainly, you know, use better tricks for how to present it. So you know, don't worry about the context, but let's say I'm trying to prove some theorem here. Then, you know, one thing I noticed is that for certain kinds of substitutions in your proofs, they're sort of so obvious that it makes sense to, like, so here I'm just sort of reminding the reader of the definition of this quantity and plugging it in. And so that's sufficiently obvious that I can just sort of erase what was there before and say, this is the new thing. You know, there's not a lot that has to go on there. But in other steps that are, you know, maybe a little bit less obvious, like here I'm using an inequality on this C quantity, which is, you know, defined in this way, I might want to sort of keep the old version around and tell you sort of what has happened so that, you know, you can now go and look and verify for yourself that indeed, you know, this inequality implies this form given this form. And so as I'm going through this, it's obviously really important that I do it at a rate where my audience, if I want my audience to follow the proof, I've got to proceed at a rate where they can really follow the proof. I have to explain everything that's going on, what all the notation means. But I can do that. And generally, you know, if I want to pull up things that I proved earlier in the talk, I always find it's good to have a sort of graphical language in your talk, a sort of visual cue. So in this talk, you know, when I proved this earlier, I sort of encircled it in this orange. And now I can tell the audience, well, you know, remember, we proved this 4 slides back. And everybody can say, oh, yes, I remember that. It looks very familiar. And now I'm going to use that and plug it in and move on. You know, a slight annoyance, which I'm sure somebody more sophisticated could deal with, is like when you get to the bottom of the page, but you need to keep going. You know, I always just sort of use the trick of sort of telling the audience that, oh, I've just rewritten here what was on the previous slide at the bottom. So I think all of this can be done better. But the point I want to make is just that I've sometimes heard that if you're going to be giving mathematical proofs, you know, you should really be doing it on the blackboard. You can't really do it successfully on PowerPoint. But I think that is really predicated on the idea that, you know, the PowerPoint is going to be bad because you're going to rush through it too quickly. But you're in control of the rate you're going. The PowerPoint is optimal because once you figure out exactly what's the right rate of proceeding on each step, you proceed at that rate. The blackboard is really slow. Imagine I tried to do this proof on the blackboard. You have to wait for me to write out all these equations with my typos and all that and the fact that I'm blocking it for a while. And it's just so much worse. So in my opinion, you know, if you have to give a proof, it's nice to sort of do it right, get all the typos out, present it in the cleanest way you can, and then make sure they present it, you know, slow enough that everybody can follow. All right, we're coming near the end. Just comment about timing. So obviously, when you give a great talk, you have to practice it. So you have to go over your talk, see how long it takes, see how that compares with the time slot you've been given. And generally, if you're anything like me, you'll find it's too long. You know, you were too ambitious, you're saying too much, it doesn't fit. So what do? The main thing you want to do is you want to go find the material that's in your talk that's actually not critical to the thesis, the main narrative point. There's always stuff in there. And in publishing, they call this, you know, kill your darlings. You know, you just wrote these, you know, 3 pages and you love them so much, but now they have to go. It's the same. You know, I will spend hours on some slides and they're perfect. They explain this so well. And then the night before, I'm like, they have to go because they don't fit. It's too long. And they're not actually critical to the main point I'm making. And that's the most important thing. You always have to give priority to the material that connects to your narrative. Once you do that, I mean, something I've noticed is that this often happens as follows, that you give a talk on a topic that lasted for an hour, and now you're asked to give another talk in the last half an hour. So what do? You go and you throw out a bunch of material and you manage to pack that into half an hour. And then the next time you give the hour-long version of the talk, you realize, I don't actually need all that old material back. That old material actually wasn't serving me. And you find that you can throw some interesting new stuff, and suddenly you can say more in an hour than you could with the original version of the talk. So there's always this sort of, I find that when you're preparing a talk, you're sort of too close to it. You don't see that certain things are not really necessary. So it's useful to give the same talk over and over again, because it always gets better every time you give it. And then the second thing, of course, is that, you know, as I've tried to explain, that, you know, if you manage to present things really well, you can have sort of more compact explanations. You can lean on, you know, figures and illustrations and equations in such a way that you can actually make for better explanations that take less time. So that's another way of fitting it into the slot. When it comes time to, you know, making sure that you give a really slick delivery, the key thing is to not just, you know, say it all as quickly as possible, but speak in the same way that you'd speak if you were trying to tell a story. So maybe there's points in the story where you know, you want to proceed at a rapid pace, but there, you know, might be other points where you want to pause, have some effect from your pauses. And so, yeah, you should do that when you're practicing so that it's you're ready for the main talk. All I'll say is that there's lots of online resources for how to be a good public speaker that are not particular to physics. So if you want to be a better speaker and figure out how to say and ah less and, you know, hold yourself, there's lots of material on that online. As I said before, you want to do lots of practicing, but also you want to find somebody to practice in front of. So if you can find an audience that matches the audience you're going to speak to, so you're going to give a talk to experts, find an audience of experts who's willing to listen to your talk. If you're going to give a public lecture, find some people who are not physicists, have them listen to your talk. These people can tell you what worked, what didn't work, you know, what made sense, where they got lost. That's really helpful feedback. And so if you can get your talk ready far enough ahead in advance and practice it out on some audiences, that's really good. Do you want to memorize anything? I say yes. There, in some, you know, with caveats, there are some things you might want to memorize. So what happens often in a talk is there'll come a point where there's something you need to say that you're always tripping up over. It's something that's hard to say. And so when you realize that in your practices, you say, oh, okay, I'm going to trip over that unless I'm better prepared. So what you do is you sort of write out a script of exactly what you want to say in that point, and you memorize that script so that when it comes time to deliver the talk, you can say that clearly without tripping up, and so the audience can actually follow what you're saying and get it. So I find that works really well. There's always bits that you're going to have trouble saying if you just try to do it off the cuff. The other thing is that, especially if it's a talk that you haven't rehearsed that much, transitions, I find, are the hardest things to remember. You know, once you're into explaining topic A, you kind of have some momentum. But in practice, you figured out, the right way to talk about the transition from topic A to topic B is this nice little segue. Those are the things that I tend to forget very easily. What was that segue? So those are the things I also try to kind of practice and, go over again. You know, memorize those transitions. Then when you're in the talk, you can sort of easily get from one topic to the next. I should say that if you're giving a talk that's really important and you want it to be really slick, like a TED talk or big public lecture or something, there's really no replacement for practicing it so many times that even though you may not have it memorized word for word what you're going to say, in a sense, all the ideas, you sort of know exactly what idea and what you're going to say, what you're going to explain, and you can sort of, it just runs on loop in your head. So I find that that's always the most effective way of giving a talk that's for a big audience. And what's beautiful about that is that if you've got it so well rehearsed, it can seem off the cuff. And it's once you get up there and you know it so well, you can now sort of respond to things like, you have an opportunity to make a joke because the phone rang. And you can be at ease because you know this talk so well that nothing's going to trip you up. And so you haven't strictly memorized it. It doesn't sound rehearsed. It actually sounds very off the cuff. You can get sort of fewer ums and ahs because you know exactly what you want to say, and you can just sort of present it smoothly and respond. And it's a very high price to pay because it takes a long time to know your talk so well that you can sort of run it through. And I find whenever I do that, it actually keeps running through my head for days afterwards. I have the talk still going on, one day later. It's kind of annoying. But it does mean that you can have a really great delivery. Okay, final point I want to make is that if you have an opportunity to give a public lecture to a non-expert audience, take it. It is a fantastic way to improve your speaking skills. And what I found, surprisingly, is that if I give a public lecture, so Ellie Wolf and I give a lecture back in 2020 on some of our research, if I give a public lecture on a topic of research, the next time I give that topic as a talk to experts, it's so much better. Because basically, all the work I did trying to figure out how to explain it to the public, I can use in that talk to the experts as a sort of the beginnings of that explanation. And it always goes so smooth. Those are the talks I always get, my colleagues telling me how good it was. They're the talks that came right after those public lectures. So it's strange, but somehow the work you put into a public lecture translates into much better talks for your colleagues. Okay, so I think I'm going to end there. So let me just say good luck with your future presentations, and thanks for your attention.